settled down, another teacher had stuck his head in the door to see what the trouble was. "It's all right," Phaedra said. "We just accidentally stumbled over a genuine question, and the shock is hard to recover from." Some students looked curious at this, and the noise simmered down. He then used the occasion for a short return to his theme of corruption and decay in the Church of Reason. It was a measure of this corruption, he said, that students should be outraged by someone trying to use them to seek the truth. You were supposed to fake this search for the truth, to imitate it. To actually search for it was a damned imposition. The truth was, he said, that he genuinely did want to know what they thought, not so that he could put a grade on it, but because he really wanted to know. They looked puzzled. "I sat there all night long," one said. "I was ready to cry, I was so mad," a girl next to the window said. "You should warn us," a third said. "How could I warn you," he said, "when I had no idea how you'd react?" Some of the puzzled ones looked at him with a first dawning. He wasn't playing games. He really wanted to know. A most peculiar person. Then someone said, "What do you think?" "I don't know," he answered. "But what do you think?" He paused for a long time. "I think there is such a thing as quality, but that as soon as you try to define it, something goes haywire. You can't do it." Murmurs of agreement. He continued, "Why this is, I don't know. I thought maybe I'd get some ideas from your papers. I just don't know." This time the class was silent. In subsequent classes that day, there was some of the same commotion, but a number of the students in each class volunteered friendly answers that told him the first class had been discussed during lunch. A few days later, he worked up a definition of his own and put it on the blackboard to be copied for posterity. The definition was, "Quality is a characteristic of thought and statement that is recognized by a non-thinking process. Because definitions are a product of rigid, formal thinking, quality cannot be defined." The fact that this definition was actually a refusal to define did not draw comment. The students had no formal training that would have told them his statement was, in a formal sense, completely irrational. If you can't define something, you have no formal rational way of knowing that it exists. Neither can you really tell anyone what it is. There is, in fact, no formal difference between inability to define and stupidity. When I say quality cannot be defined, I'm really saying formally, I'm stupid about quality. Fortunately, the students didn't know this. If they'd come up with these objections, he wouldn't have been able to answer them at the time. But then, below the definition on the blackboard, he wrote, "But even though quality cannot be defined, you know what quality is." And the storm started all over again. "Oh, no, we don't." "Oh, yes, you do." "Oh, no, we don't." "Oh, yes, you do," he said. And he had some material ready to demonstrate it to them. He had selected two examples of student composition. The first was a rambling, disconnected thing with interesting ideas that never built into anything. The second was a magnificent piece by a student who was mystified himself about why it had come out so well. Phaedrus read both, then asked for a show of hands on who thought the first was best. Two hands went up. He asked how many liked the second better. 28 hands went up. "Whatever it is," he said, "that caused the overwhelming majority to raise their hands for the second one is what I mean by quality. So you know what it is." There was a long reflective silence after this, and he just let it last. This was just intellectually outrageous, and he knew it. He wasn't teaching anymore, he was indoctrinating. He had erected an imaginary entity, defined it as incapable of definition, told the students over their own protests that they knew what it was, and demonstrated this by a technique that was as confusing logically as the term itself. He was able to get away with this because logical refutation required more talent than any of the students had. In subsequent days, he continually invited their refutations, but none came. He improvised further. To reinforce the idea that they already knew what quality was, he developed a routine in which he read four student papers in class and had everyone rank them in estimated order of quality on a slip of paper. He did the same himself. He collected the slips, tallied them on the blackboard, and averaged the rankings for an overall class opinion. Then he would reveal his own rankings, and this would almost always be close to, if not identical with, the class average. Where there were differences, it was usually because two papers were close in quality. At first, the classes were excited by this exercise, but as time went on, they became bored. What he meant by quality was obvious. They obviously knew what it was, too, and so they lost interest in listening. Their question now was, "All right, we know what quality is. How do we get it?" Now, at last, the standard rhetoric texts came into their own. The principles expounded in them were no longer rules to rebel against, not ultimates in themselves, but just techniques, gimmicks, for producing what really counted, and stood independently of the techniques. Quality. What had started out as a heresy from traditional rhetoric turned into a beautiful introduction to it. He singled out aspects of quality such as unity, vividness, authority, economy, sensitivity, clarity, emphasis, flow, suspense, brilliance, precision, proportion, depth, and so on. Kept each of these as poorly defined as quality itself, but demonstrated them by the same class reading techniques. He showed how the aspect of quality called unity, the hanging togetherness of a story, could be improved with a technique called an outline. The authority of an argument could be jacked up with a technique called footnotes, which gives authoritative reference. Outlines and footnotes are standard things taught in all freshman composition classes, but now as devices for improving quality, they had a purpose. And if a student turned in a bunch of dumb references or a sloppy outline that showed he was just fulfilling an assignment by rote, he could be told that while his paper may have fulfilled the letter of the assignment, it obviously didn't fulfill the goal of quality, and was therefore worthless. Now, in answer to that eternal student question, "How do I do this?" that had frustrated him to the point of resignation, he could reply, "It doesn't make a bit of difference how you do it, just so it's good." The reluctant student might ask in class, "But how do we know what's good?" But almost before the question was out of his mouth, he would realize the answer had already been supplied. Some other student would usually tell him, "You just see it." If he said, "No, I don't," he'd be told, "Yes, you do. He proved it." The student was finally and completely trapped into making quality judgments for himself. And it was just exactly this and nothing else that taught him to write. Up to now, Phaedrus had been compelled by the academic system to say what he wanted, even though he knew that this forced students to conform to artificial forms that destroyed their own creativity. Students who went along with his rules were then condemned for their inability to be creative or produce a piece of work that reflected their own personal standards of what is good. Now that was over with. By reversing a basic rule that all things which are to be taught must first be defined, he had found a way out of all this. He was pointing to no principle, no rule of good writing, no theory, but he was pointing to something nevertheless that was very real, whose reality they couldn't deny. The vacuum that had been created by the withholding of grades was suddenly filled with the positive goal of quality, and the whole thing fit together. Students, astonished, came by his office and said, "I used to just hate English. Now I spend more time on it than anything else." Not just one or two, many. The whole quality concept was beautiful. It worked. It was that mysterious individual internal goal of each creative person on the blackboard at last. I turn to see how Chris is doing. His face looks tired. I ask, "How do you feel?" "Okay," he says, but his tone is defiant. "We can stop anywhere in camp," I say. He flashes a fierce look at me, and so I say nothing more. Soon I see he's working his way around me on the slope. With what must be great effort, he pulls ahead. We go on. Phaedrus got this far with his concept of quality because he deliberately refused to look outside the immediate classroom experience. Cromwell's statement, "No one ever travels so high as he knows not where he is going," applied at this point. He didn't know where he was going. All he knew was that it worked. In time, however, He wondered why it worked, especially when he already knew it was irrational. Why should an irrational method work when rational methods were also rotten? He had an intuitive feeling, growing rapidly, that what he had stumbled on was no small gimmick. It went far beyond. How far, he didn't know. This was the beginning of the crystallization that I talked about before. Others wondered at the time, why should he get so excited about quality? But they saw only the word and its rhetoric context. They didn't see his past despair over abstract questions of existence itself that he had abandoned in defeat. If anyone else had asked, what is quality, it would have been just another question. But when he asked it, because of his past, it spread out for him like waves in all directions simultaneously. Not in a hierarchic structure, but in a concentric one. At the center, generating the waves, was quality. As these waves of thought expanded for him, I'm sure he fully expected each wave to reach some shore of existing patterns of thought, so that he had a kind of unified relationship with these thought structures. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsig continued. Cassette 6, Side 1. As these waves of thought expanded for him, I'm sure he fully expected each wave to reach some shore of existing patterns of thought, so that he had a kind of unified relationship with these thought structures. But the shore was never reached until the end, if it appeared at all. For him, there was nothing but ever-expanding waves of crystallization. I'll now try to follow these waves of crystallization, the second phase of his exploration into quality, as best I can. Up ahead, all of Chris's movements seem tired and angry. He stumbles on things, lets branches tear at him, instead of pulling them to one side. I'm sorry to see this. Some blame can be put on the YMCA camp he attended for 2 weeks just before we started. From what he's told me, they make a big ego thing out of the whole outdoor experience. A proof of manhood thing. He began in a lowly class they were careful to point out was rather disgraceful to be in. Original sin. Then he was allowed to prove himself with a long series of accomplishments. Swimming, rope tying. He mentioned a dozen of them, but I've forgotten them. It made the kids at camp much more enthusiastic and cooperative when they had ego goals to fulfill, I'm sure. But ultimately, that kind of motivation is destructive. Any effort that has self-glorification as its final endpoint is bound to end in disaster. Now we're paying the price. When you try to climb a mountain to prove how big you are, you almost never make it. And even if you do, it's a hollow victory. In order to sustain the victory, you have to prove yourself again and again in some other way. And again and again and again, driven forever to fill a false image, haunted by the fear that the image is not true, and someone will find out. That's never the way. Phaedrus wrote a letter from India about a pilgrimage to Holy Mount Kailas, the source of the Ganges, and the abode of Shiva, high in the Himalayas, in the company of a holy man and his adherents. He never reached the mountain. After the third day, he gave up, exhausted, and the pilgrimage went on without him. He said he had the physical strength, but that physical strength wasn't enough. He had the intellectual motivation, but that wasn't enough either. He didn't think he had been arrogant, but thought that he was undertaking the pilgrimage to broaden his experience, to gain understanding for himself. He was trying to use the mountain for his own purposes, and the pilgrimage too. He regarded himself as the fixed entity, not the pilgrimage or the mountain, and thus wasn't ready for it. He speculated that the other pilgrims, the ones who reached the mountain, probably sensed the holiness of the mountain so intensely that each footstep was an act of devotion, an act of submission to this holiness. The holiness of the mountain infused into their own spirits enabled them to endure far more than anything he, with his greater physical strength, could take. To the untrained eye, ego climbing and selfless climbing may appear identical. Both kinds of climbers place one foot in front of the other. Both breathe in and out at the same rate. Both stop when tired. Both go forward when rested. but what a difference. The ego climber is like an instrument that's out of adjustment. He puts his foot down an instant too soon or too late. He's likely to miss a beautiful passage of sunlight through the trees. He goes on when the sloppiness of his step shows he's tired. He rests at odd times. He looks up the trail trying to see what's ahead, even when he knows what's ahead, because he just looked a second before. He goes too fast or too slow for the conditions, and when he talks, his talk is forever about somewhere else, something else. He's here, but he's not here. He rejects the here, is unhappy with it, wants to be farther up the trail, but when he gets there, will be just as unhappy because then it will be here. What he's looking for, what he wants, is all around him. But he doesn't want that because it is all around him. Every step's an effort, both physically and spiritually, because he imagines his goal to be external and distant. That seems to be Chris's problem now. Chapter 18. There's an entire branch of philosophy concerned with the definition of quality, known as aesthetics. Its question, what is meant by beautiful, goes back to antiquity. But when he was a student of philosophy, Phaedrus had recoiled violently from this entire branch of knowledge. He had almost deliberately failed the one course in it he had attended, and had written a number of papers subjecting the instructor and materials to outrageous attack. He hated and reviled everything. It wasn't any particular aesthetician who produced this reaction in him. It was all of them. It wasn't any particular point of view that outraged him, so much as the idea that quality should be subordinated to any point of view. The intellectual process was forcing quality into its servitude, prostituting it. I think that was the source of his anger. He wrote in one paper, "These aestheticians think their subject is some kind of peppermint bonbon they're entitled to smack their fat lips on. Something to be devoured. Something to be intellectually knifed, forked, and spooned up bit by bit with appropriate delicate remarks, and I'm ready to throw up. What they smack their lips on is the putrescence of something they long ago killed." Now, as the first step of the crystallization process, he saw that when quality is kept undefined by definition, the entire field called aesthetics is wiped out. Completely disenfranchised. Kaput. By refusing to define quality, he had placed it entirely outside the analytic process. If you can't define quality, there's no way you can subordinate it to any intellectual rule. The aestheticians can have nothing more to say. Their whole field, definition of quality, is gone. The thought of this completely thrilled him. It was like discovering a cancer cure. No more explanations of what art is. No more wonderful critical schools of experts to determine rationally where each composer had succeeded or failed. All of them, every last one of those know-it-alls, would finally have to shut up. This was no longer just an interesting idea. This was a dream. I don't think anyone really saw what he was up to at first. They saw an intellectual delivering a message that had all the trappings of a rational analysis of a teaching situation. They didn't see he had a purpose completely opposite to any they were used to. He wasn't furthering rational analysis. He was blocking it. He was turning the method of rationality against itself, turning it against his own kind in defense of an irrational concept, an undefined entity called quality. He wrote, 1. Every instructor of English composition knows what quality is. Any instructor who does not should keep this fact carefully concealed, for this would certainly constitute proof of incompetence. 2. Any instructor who thinks quality of writing can and should be defined before teaching it, can and should go ahead and define it. 3. All those who feel that quality of writing does exist, but cannot be defined, but that quality should be taught anyway, can benefit by the following method of teaching pure quality in writing without defining it. He then went ahead and described some of the methods of comparison that had evolved in the classroom. I think he really did hope that someone would come along, challenge him, and try to define quality for him. But no one ever did. However, that little parenthetic statement about inability to recognize quality as proof of incompetence did raise eyebrows within the department.
He was, after all, the junior member, and not really expected to provide standards quite yet for his senior's performance. His right to say as he pleased was valued, and the senior members actually seemed to enjoy his independence of thought and support him in a church-like way. But contrary to the belief of many opponents of academic freedom, the church attitude has never been that a teacher should be allowed to blather anything that comes into his head without any accountability at all. The church attitude is simply that the accountability must be to the God of reason, not to the idols of political power. The fact that he was insulting people was irrelevant to the truth or falsehood of what he was saying, and he couldn't ethically be struck down for this. But what they were prepared to strike him down for, ethically and with gusto, was any indication that he wasn't making sense. He could do anything he wanted as long as he justified it in terms of reason. But how the hell do you ever justify, in terms of reason, a refusal to define something? Definitions are the foundation of reason. You can't reason without them. He could hold off the attack for a while with fancy dialectical footwork and insults about competence and incompetence, but sooner or later he had to come up with something more substantial than that. His attempt to come up with something substantial led to further crystallization beyond the traditional limits of rhetoric and into the domain of philosophy. Chris turns and flashes a tormented look at me. It won't be long now. Even before we left, there were clues this was coming. When Deweese told a neighbor I was experienced in the mountains, Chris showed a big flash of admiration. It was a large thing in his eyes. He should be done for soon, and then we can stop for the day. Oop. There he goes. He's fallen down. He's not getting up. It was an awfully neat fall, not very accidental looking. Now he looks at me with hurt and anger, searching for condemnation from me. I don't show him any. I sit down next to him and see he's almost defeated. Well, I say, we can stop here, or we can go ahead, or we can go back. Which do you want to do? I don't care, he says. I don't want to. You don't want to what? I don't care, he says angrily. Then since you don't care, we'll keep on going, I say, trapping him. I don't like this trip, he says. It isn't any fun. I thought it was going to be fun. Some anger catches me off guard, too. That may be true, I reply, but it's a hell of a thing to say. I see a sudden flick of fear in his eyes as he gets up. We go on. The sky over the other wall of the canyon has become overcast, and the wind in the pines around us has become cool and ominous. At least the coolness makes it easier hiking. I was talking about the first wave of crystallization outside of rhetoric that resulted from Phaedrus's refusal to define quality. He had to answer the question, if you can't define it, what makes you think it exists? His answer was an old one belonging to a philosophic school that called itself realism. A thing exists, he said, if a world without it can't function normally. If we can show that a world without quality functions abnormally, then we have shown that quality exists, whether it's defined or not. He thereupon proceeded to subtract quality from a description of the world as we know it. The first casualty from such a subtraction, he said, would be the fine arts. If you can't distinguish between good and bad in the arts, they disappear. There's no point in hanging a painting on the wall when the bare wall looks just as good. There's no point to symphonies when scratches from the record or hum from the record player sound just as good. Poetry would disappear, since it seldom makes sense and has no practical value. And, interestingly, comedy would vanish too. No one would understand the jokes, since the difference between humor and no humor is pure quality. Next, he made sports disappear. Football, baseball, games of every sort would vanish. The scores would no longer be a measurement of anything meaningful, but simply empty statistics, like the number of stones in a pile of gravel. Who would attend them? Who would play? Next, he subtracted quality from the marketplace and predicted the changes that would take place. Since quality of flavor would be meaningless, supermarkets would carry only basic grains, such as rice, cornmeal, soybeans, and flour. Possibly also some ungrated meat, milk for weaning infants, and vitamin and mineral supplements to make up deficiencies. Alcoholic beverages, tea, coffee, and tobacco would vanish. So would movies, dances, plays, and parties. We would all use public transportation. We would all wear GI shoes. A huge proportion of us would be out of work, but this would probably be temporary until we relocated in essential non-quality work. Applied science and technology would be drastically changed, but pure science, mathematics, philosophy, and particularly logic, would be unchanged. Phaedrus found this last to be extremely interesting. The purely intellectual pursuits were the least affected by the subtraction of quality. If quality were dropped, only rationality would remain unchanged. That was odd. Why would that be? He didn't know, but he did know that by subtracting quality from a picture of the world as we know it, he'd revealed a magnitude of importance of this term he hadn't known was there. The world can function without it, but life would be so dull as to be hardly worth living. In fact, it wouldn't be worth living. The term worth is a quality term. Life would just be living without any values or purpose at all. He looked back over the distance this line of thought had taken him, and decided he'd certainly proved his point. Since the world obviously doesn't function normally when quality is subtracted, quality exists, whether it's defined or not. After conjuring up this vision of a qualityless world, he was soon attracted to its resemblance to a number of social situations he had already read about. Ancient Sparta came to mind, communist Russia and her satellites. Communist China, the Brave New World of Aldous Huxley, and the 1984 of George Orwell. He also remembered people from his own experience who would have endorsed this qualityless world. The same ones who tried to make him quit smoking. They wanted rational reasons for his smoking, and, when he didn't have any, acted very superior, as though he'd lost face or something. They had to have reasons and plans and solutions for everything. They were his own kind, the kind he was now attacking. And he searched for a long time for a suitable name to sum up just what characterized them, so as to get a handle on this qualityless world. It was intellectual primarily, but it wasn't just intelligence that was fundamental. It was a certain basic attitude about the way the world was, a presumptive vision that it ran according to laws, reason, and that man's improvement lay chiefly through the discovery of these laws of reason and application of them toward satisfaction of his own desires. It was this faith that held everything together. He squinted at this vision of a qualityless world for a while, conjured up more details, thought about it, and then squinted some more, and thought some more, and then finally circled back to where he was before. Squareness. That's the look. That sums it. Squareness. When you subtract quality, you get squareness. Absence of quality is the essence of squareness. Some artist friends with whom he had once traveled across the United States came to mind. They were Negroes, who had always been complaining about just this qualitylessness he was describing. Square. That was their word for it. Way back, long ago, before the mass media had picked it up and given it natural white usage, they had called all that intellectual stuff square and had wanted nothing to do with it. And there had been a fantastic mismeshing of conversations and attitudes between him and them, because he was such a prime example of the squareness they were talking about. The more he had tried to pin them down on what they were talking about, the vaguer they had gotten. Now, with this quality, he seemed to say the same thing, and talk as vaguely as they did, even though what he talked about was as hard and clear and solid as any rationally defined entity he'd ever dealt with. Quality. That's what they'd been talking about all the time. "Man, will you just please kindly dig it?" he remembered one of them saying. "And hold up on all those wonderful $7 questions. If you got to ask what is it all the time, you'll never get time to know." Soul. Quality. The same. The wave of crystallization rolled ahead. He was seeing two worlds simultaneously. On the intellectual side, the square side, He saw now that quality was a cleavage term, what every intellectual analyst looks for. You take your analytic knife, put the point directly on the term quality, and just tap. Not hard, gently. And the whole world splits, cleaves, right in two. Hip and square, classic and romantic, technological and humanistic. And the split is clean. There's no mess, no slop. No little items that could be one way or the other. Not just a skilled break, but a very lucky break. Sometimes the best analysts, working with the most obvious lines of cleavage, can tap and get nothing but a pile of trash. And yet here was quality, a tiny, almost unnoticeable fault line. A line of illogic in our concept of the universe, and you tapped it, and the whole universe came apart so neatly it was almost unbelievable. He wished Kant were alive. Kant would have appreciated it. That master diamond cutter. He would see. Hold quality undefined. That was the secret. Phaedrus wrote, with some beginning awareness that he was involved in a strange kind of intellectual suicide, "Squareness may be succinctly and yet thoroughly defined as an inability to see quality before it's been intellectually defined. That is, before it gets all chopped up into words. We have proved that quality, though undefined, exists. Its existence can be seen empirically in the classroom, and can be demonstrated logically by showing that a world without it cannot exist as we know it. What remains to be seen, the thing to be analyzed, is not quality, but those peculiar habits of thought called squareness that sometimes prevent us from seeing it." Thus did he seek to turn the attack. The subject for analysis, the patient on the table, was no longer quality, but analysis itself. Quality was healthy and in good shape. Analysis, however, seemed to have something wrong with it that prevented it from seeing the obvious. I look back and see Chris is way behind. "Come on!" I shout. He doesn't answer. "Come on!" I shout it again. Then I see him fall sideways and sit in the grass on the side of the mountain. I leave my pack and go back down to him. The slope is steep. I have to dig my feet in sideways. When I get there, he's crying.
"I hurt my ankle,"
he says, and doesn't look at me. When an ego climber has an image of himself to protect, he naturally lies to protect this image. But it's disgusting to see, and I'm ashamed of myself for letting this happen. Now my own willingness to continue becomes eroded by his tears, and his inner sense of defeat passes to me. I sit down, live with this for a while, then, without turning away from it, pick up his backpack and say to him, "I'll carry the packs and relays. I'll take this one up to where mine is, and then you stop and wait with it, so we don't lose it. Then I'll take mine up farther, and then come back for yours. That way you can get plenty of rest. It'll be slower, but we'll get there." But I've done this too soon. There's still disgust and resentment in my voice, which he hears and is shamed by. He shows anger, but says nothing, for fear he'll have to carry the pack again, just frowns and ignores me while I relay the packs upward. I work off the resentment at having to do this by realizing that it isn't any more work for me, actually, than the other way. It's more work in terms of reaching the top of the mountain, but that's only the nominal goal. In terms of the real goal, putting in good minutes, one after the other, it comes out the same. In fact, better. We climb slowly upward, and the resentment leaves. For the next hour, we move slowly upward, I carrying the packs and relays, to where I locate the beginning trickle of a stream. I send Chris down for water in one of the pans, which he gets. When he comes back, he says, "Why are we stopping here? Let's keep going." "This is probably the last stream we'll see for a long time, Chris, and I'm tired." "Why are you so tired?" Is he trying to infuriate me? He's succeeding. "I'm tired, Chris, because I'm carrying the packs. If you're in a hurry to take your pack and go on up ahead, I'll catch up with you." He looks at me with another flick of fear, then sits down.
"I don't like this," he says, almost in tears. "I hate this. I'm sorry I came. Why did we come here?"
He's crying again hard. I reply, You make me very sorry, too. You better have something for lunch.
I don't want anything. My stomach hurts.
Suit yourself. He goes off a distance and picks up a stem of grass and puts it in his mouth. Then he buries his face in his hands. I make lunch for myself and have a short rest. When I wake up again, he's still crying. There's nowhere for either of us to go. Nothing to do but face up to the existing situation. But I really don't know what the existing situation is. Chris, I say finally. He doesn't answer. Chris, I repeat. Still no answer. He finally says, belligerently,
What?
I was going to say, Chris, that you don't have to prove anything to me. Do you understand that? A real flash of terror hits his face. He jerks his head away violently. I say, You don't understand what I mean by that, do you? He continues to look away and doesn't answer. The wind moans through the pines. I just don't know. I just don't know what it is. It isn't just YMCA egotism that's making him this upset. Some minor thing reflects badly on him, and it's the end of the world. When he tries to do something and doesn't get it just right, he blows up or goes into tears. I settle back into the grass and rest again. Maybe it's not having answers that's defeating both of us. I don't want to go ahead because it doesn't look like any answers ahead. None behind, either. Just lateral drift. That's what it is between me and him. Lateral drift. Waiting for something. Later I hear him prowl at the knapsack. I roll over and see him glaring at me. Where's the cheese? He says. The tone's still belligerent. But I'm not going to give in to it. Help yourself, I say. I'm not waiting on you. He digs around and finds some cheese and crackers. I give him my hunting knife to spread the cheese with. I think what I'm going to do, Chris, is put all the heavy stuff in my pack and the light stuff in yours. That way, I won't have to go back and forth with both packs. He agrees to this, and his mood improves. It seems to have solved something for him. My pack must be about 40 or 45 pounds now, and after we've climbed for a while, an equilibrium establishes itself, at about one breath for each step. We come to a rough grade, and it changes to 2 breaths per step. At one bank, it goes to 4 breaths per step. Huge steps, almost vertical, hanging onto roots and branches. I feel stupid because I should have planned my way around this. The aspen staves come in handy now, and Chris takes some interest in the use of his. The packs make you top-heavy, and the sticks are good insurance against toppling over. You plant 1 foot, plant the staff, then swing on it, up and take 3 breaths, then plant the next foot, plant the staff, and swing up. I don't know if I've got any more Chautauqua left in me today. My head gets fuzzy about this time in the afternoon. Maybe I can establish just one overview and let it go for today. Way back long ago, when we first set out on this strange voyage, I talked about how John and Sylvia seemed to be running from some mysterious death force that seemed to them to be embodied in technology, and that there were many others like them. I talked for a while about how some of the people involved in technology seemed to be avoiding it too. An underlying reason for this trouble was that they saw it from a kind of groovy dimension that was concerned with the immediate surface of things, whereas I was concerned with the underlying form. I called John's style romantic, mine classic. His was, in the argot of the 60s, hip. Mine was square. Then we started going into this square world to see what made it tick. Data, classifications, hierarchies, cause and effect, and analysis were discussed. And somewhere along there was some talk about a handful of sand, the world of which we're conscious, taken from the endless landscape of awareness around us. I said a process of discrimination goes to work on this handful of sand, and divides it into parts. Classical square understanding is concerned with the piles of sand and the nature of the grains and the basis for sorting and interrelating them. Phaedrus's refusal to define quality, in terms of this analogy, was an attempt to break the grip of the classical sand-sifting mode of understanding and find a point of common understanding between the classic and romantic worlds. Quality, the cleavage term between hip and square, seemed to be it. Both worlds used the term. Both knew what it was. It was just that the romantic left it alone and appreciated it for what it was, and the classic tried to turn it into a set of intellectual building blocks for other purposes. Now, with the definition blocked, the classic mind was forced to view quality as the romantic did, undistorted by thought structures. I'm making a big thing out of all this, these classical romantic differences, but Phaedrus didn't. He wasn't really interested in any kind of fusion of differences between those two worlds. He was after something else. His ghost. In the pursuit of this ghost, he went on to wider meanings of quality, which drew him further and further to his end. I differ from him in that I've no intention of going on to that end. He just passed through this territory and opened it up. I intend to stay and cultivate it, and see if I can get something to grow. I think that the referent of a term that can split a world into hip and square, classic and romantic, technological and humanistic, is an entity that can unite a world already split along those lines into one. A real understanding of quality doesn't just serve the system, or even beat it, or even escape it. A real understanding of quality captures the system, tames it, and puts it to work for one's own personal use, while leaving one completely free to fulfill his inner destiny. Now that we're up high on one side of the canyon, we can see back and down and across to the other side. It's as steep there as it is here, a dark mat of greenish-black pines going up to a high ridge. We can measure our progress by sighting against it at what seems like a horizontal angle. That's all the quality talk for today, I guess, thank goodness. I don't mind the quality, it's just that all the classical talk about it isn't quality. Quality is just the focal point around which a lot of intellectual furniture is getting rearranged. We stop for a break and look down below. Chris's spirits seem to be better now, but I'm afraid it's the ego thing again. "Look how far we've come," he says. "We've got a lot farther to go." Later on, Chris shouts to hear his echo and throws rocks down to see where they fall. He's starting to get almost cocky, so I step up the equilibrium to where I breathe at a good swift rate, about 1.5 times our former speed. This sobers him somewhat, and we keep on climbing. By about 3 in the afternoon, my legs start to get rubbery, and it's time to stop. I'm not in very good shape. If you go on after that rubbery feeling, you start to pull muscles, and the next day is agony. We come to a flat spot, a large knoll protruding from the side of the mountain. I tell Chris this is it for today. He seems satisfied and cheerful. Maybe some progress has been made with him after all. I'm ready for a nap, but clouds have formed in the canyon that appear ready to drop rain. They've filled in the canyon so that we can't see the bottom, and can just barely see the ridge on the other side. I break open the packs and get the tent halves out, army ponchos, and snap them together. I take a rope and tie it between the 2 trees, then throw the shelter halves over it. I cut some stakes out of shrubs with the machete and pound them in, then dig a small trench with the flat end of the machete around the tent to drain away any rainwater. We've just got everything inside when the first rain comes down. Chris is in high spirits about the rain. We lie on our backs on the sleeping bags and watch the rain come down and hear its popping sound on the tent. The forest has a misty appearance, and we both become contemplative and watch the leaves of the shrubs jolt when struck by raindrops, and jolt a little ourselves when a clash of thunder comes down, but feel happy that we're dry when everything around us is wet. After a while, I reach into my pack for the paperback by Thoreau, find it, and have to strain a little to read it to Chris in the gray, rainy light. I guess I've explained that we've done this with other books in the past, advanced books that he wouldn't normally understand. What happens is I read a sentence, he comes up with a long series of questions about it, and then, when he's satisfied, I read the next sentence. We do this with Thoreau for a while, but after half an hour I see to my surprise and disappointment that Thoreau isn't coming through. Chris is restless, and so am I. The language structure is wrong for the mountain forest we're in. At least that's my feeling. The book seems tame and cloistered, something I'd never have thought of Thoreau, but there it is. He's talking to another situation, another time, just discovering the evils of technology, rather than discovering the solution. He isn't talking to us. Reluctantly, I put the book away again, and we're both silent and meditative. It's just Chris and me in the forest and the rain. No books can guide us anymore. Pans we've set outside the tent begin to fill up with rainwater, and later, when we have enough, we pour it all together in a pot and add some cubes of chicken bouillon and heat it over a small sterno stove. Like any food or drink after a hard climb in the mountains, it tastes good. Chris says, "I like camping with you better than with the Sutherlands." "The circumstances are different," I say. When the bouillon is gone, I get out a can of pork and beans and empty it into the pot. It takes a long time to heat up, but we're in no hurry. "It smells good," Chris says. The rain has stopped, and just occasional drops pat down on the tent. "I think tomorrow will be sunny," I say. We pass the pot of pork and beans back and forth, eating from opposite sides. "Dad, what do you think about all the time? You're always thinking all the time."
"Oh, all kinds of things."
"What about?"
"Oh, about the rain, and about troubles that can happen, and about things in general."
"What things?"
"Oh, about what it's going to be like for you when you grow up." He's interested.
"What's it going to be like?"
But there's a slight ego gleam in his eyes as he asks this, and the answer, as a result, comes out masked. "I don't know," I say. "It's just what I think about."
"Do you think we'll get to the top of this canyon by tomorrow?"
"Oh, yes. We're not far from the top."
"In the morning?"
"I think so." Later he is asleep, and a damp night wind comes down from the ridge, causing a sighing sound from the pines. The silhouettes of the treetops move gently with the wind. They yield and then return, then with a sigh yield and return again, restless from forces that are not part of their nature. The wind causes a flutter of one side of the tent. I get up and peg it down, then walk on the damp spongy grass of the knoll for a while, then crawl back into the tent and wait for sleep.
Chapter 19. A mat of sunlit pine needles by my face slowly tells me where I am and helps dispel a dream. In the dream, I was standing in a white-painted room looking at a glass door. On the other side was Chris and his brother and mother. Chris was waving at me from the other side of the door, and his brother was smiling, but his mother had tears in her eyes. Then I saw that Chris's smile was fixed and artificial, and actually, there was deep fear. I moved toward the door, and his smile became better. He motioned for me to open it. I was about to open it, but then didn't. His fear came back, but I turned and walked away. It's a dream that has occurred often before. Its meaning is obvious and fits some thoughts of last night. He's trying to relate to me and is afraid he never will. Things are getting clearer up here. Beyond the flap of the tent now, the needles on the ground send vapors of mist up toward the sun. The air feels moist and cool, and while Chris still sleeps, I get out of the tent carefully, stand up and stretch. My legs and back are stiff, but not painful. I do some calisthenics for a few minutes to loosen them up, then sprint from the knoll into the pines. That feels better. The pine odor is heavy and moist this morning. I squat and look down at the morning mists in the canyon below. Later I return to the tent, where a noise indicates that Chris is awake, and when I look inside I see his face stare around silently. He's a slow waker, and it'll be 5 minutes before his mind warms up to the point where he can speak. Now he squints into the sunlight. "Good morning," I say. No answer. A few raindrops fall down from the pines. Did you sleep well?
No.
That's too bad. How come you're up so early? He asks.
It's not early.
What time is it?
9 o'clock, I say.
I bet we didn't go to sleep until 3.
3?
If he stayed awake, he's going to pay for it today.
Well, I got to sleep, I say.
He looks at me strangely.
You kept me awake.
Me?
Talking.
In my sleep, you mean?
No, about the mountain.
Something is odd here.
I don't know anything about a mountain, Chris.
Well, you talked all night about it.
You said at the top of the mountain we'd see everything. You said you were going to meet me there.
I think he's been dreaming. How could I meet you there when I'm already with you?
I don't know. You said it.
He looks upset.
You sounded like you were drunk or something.
He's still half asleep. I'd better let him wake up peacefully. But I'm thirsty and remember I left the canteen behind, thinking we'd find enough water as we traveled.
Dumb.
There'll be no breakfast now until we're up over the ridge and far enough down to the other side where we can find a spring.
We'd better pack up and go, I say, if we're going to get some water for breakfast.
It's already warm out and probably will be hot this afternoon. The tent comes down easily, and I'm pleased to see that everything stayed dry. In a half hour, we're packed. Now, except for beaten down grass, the area looks as if no one had been here. We still have a lot of climbing to do, but on the trail we discover it's easier than yesterday. We're getting to the rounded upper portion of the ridge, and the slope isn't as steep. It looks as though the pines have never been cut here. All direct sunlight is shut out from the forest floor, and there's no underbrush at all. Just a springy floor of needles that's open and spacious, and easy hiking. Time to get on with the Chautauqua, and the second wave of crystallization, the metaphysical one. This was brought about in response to Phaedrus's wild meanderings about quality, when the English faculty at Bozeman, informed of their squareness, presented him with a reasonable question. Does this undefined quality of yours exist in the things we observe, they asked, or is it subjective, existing only in the observer? It was a simple, normal enough question, and there was no hurry for an answer.
Ha! There was no need for hurry.
It was a finisher offer, a knockdown question, a haymaker, a Saturday night special, the kind you don't recover from. But if quality exists in the object, then you must explain just why scientific instruments are unable to detect it. You must suggest instruments that will detect it, or live with the explanation that instruments don't detect it because your whole quality concept, to put it politely, is a large pile of nonsense. On the other hand, if quality is subjective, existing only in the observer, then this quality that you make so much of is just a fancy name for whatever you like. What Phaedrus had been presented with by the faculty of the English department of Montana State College was an ancient logical construct known as a dilemma. A dilemma, which is Greek for two premises, has been likened to the front end of an angry and charging bull. If he accepted the premise that quality was objective, he was impaled on one horn of the dilemma. If he accepted the other premise that quality was subjective, he was impaled on the other horn. Either quality is objective or subjective. Therefore, he was impaled no matter how he answered. He noticed that from a number of faculty members he was receiving some good-natured smiles. Phaedrus, however, because of his training in logic, was aware that every dilemma affords not two, but three classic refutations. And he also knew of a few that weren't so classic. So he smiled back. He could take the left horn and refute the idea that objectivity implied scientific detectability, or he could take the right horn and refute the idea that subjectivity implies anything you like. Or he could go between the horns and deny that subjectivity or objectivity are the only choices. You may be sure he tested out all three.
Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsig continued. Cassette 6, Side 2.
He could take the left horn and refute the idea that objectivity implied scientific detectability, or he could take the right horn and refute the idea that subjectivity implies anything you like. Or he could go between the horns and deny that subjectivity and objectivity are the only choices. You may be sure he tested out all three. In addition to these three classical logical refutations, there are some illogical rhetorical ones. Phaedrus, being a rhetorician, had these available too. One may throw sand in the bull's eyes. He had already done this with his statement that lack of knowledge of what quality is constitutes incompetence. It's an old rule of logic that the competence of a speaker has no relevance to the truth of what he says, and so talk of incompetence was pure sand. The world's biggest fool can say the sun is shining, but that doesn't make it dark out. Socrates, that ancient enemy of rhetorical argument, would have sent Phaedrus flying for this one, saying, "Yes, I accept your premise that I'm incompetent in the matter of quality. Now please show an incompetent old man what quality is. Otherwise, how am I to improve?" Phaedrus would have been allowed to stew around for a few minutes, and then been flattened with questions that proved he didn't know what quality was either, and was, by his own standards, incompetent. One may attempt to sing the bull to sleep. Phaedrus could have told his questioners that the answer to this dilemma was beyond his humble powers of solution, but the fact that he couldn't find an answer was no logical proof that an answer couldn't be found. Wouldn't they, with their broader experience, try to help him find this answer? But it was way too late for lullabies like that. They could simply have replied, "No, we're way too square. And until you come up with an answer, stick to the syllabus so that we don't have to flunk out your mixed-up students when we get them next quarter." A third rhetorical alternative to the dilemma, and the best one in my opinion, was to refuse to enter the arena. Phaedrus could simply have said, "The attempt to classify quality as subjective or objective is an attempt to define it. I have already said it is undefinable," and left it at that. I believe Deweese actually counseled him to do this at the time. Why he chose to disregard this advice and chose to respond to this dilemma logically and dialectically rather than take the easy escape of mysticism, I don't know. But I can guess. I think, first of all, that he felt the whole Church of Reason was irreversibly in the arena of logic, that when one put oneself outside logical disputation, one put oneself outside any academic consideration whatsoever. Philosophical mysticism, the idea that truth is indefinable and can be apprehended only by non-rational means, has been with us since the beginning of history. It's the basis of Zen practice. But it's not an academic subject. The Academy, the Church of Reason, is concerned exclusively with those things that can be defined. And if one wants to be a mystic, his place is in a monastery, not a university. Universities are places where things should be spelled out. I think a second reason for his decision to enter the arena was an egoistic one. He knew himself to be a pretty sharp logician and dialectician, took pride in this, and looked upon this present dilemma as a challenge to his skill. I think now that trace of egotism may have been the beginning of all his troubles. I see a deer move about 200 yards ahead and above us through the pines. I try to point it out to Chris, but by the time he looks, it's gone. The first horn of Phaedrus's dilemma was, if quality exists in the object, why can't scientific instruments detect it? This horn was a mean one. From the start, he saw how deadly it was. If he was going to presume to be some super-scientist who could see an object's quality that no scientist could detect, he was just proving himself to be a nut or a fool or both. In today's world, ideas that are incompatible with scientific knowledge don't get off the ground. He remembered Locke's statement that no object, scientific or otherwise, is knowable except in terms of its qualities. This irrefutable truth seemed to suggest that the reason scientists cannot detect quality in objects is because quality is all they detect. The object is an intellectual construct deduced from the qualities. This answer, if valid, certainly smashed the first horn of the dilemma, and for a while excited him greatly. But it turned out to be false. The quality that he and the students had been seeing in the classroom was completely different from the qualities of color or heat or hardness observed in the laboratory. Those physical properties were all measurable with instruments. His quality, excellence, worth,